I'm going to speak primarily tonight about Iran and its nuclear program and where it is and what the options that are in front of us. And during the Q&A, I'd be happy to take questions on anything, so feel free. When David mentioned that I once worked as an analyst at the CIA, I was an analyst and hence not undercover. Had I been undercover, he would, of course, had to have killed you all for revealing that. From 1980 until 1983, I was the principal analyst on Iran at the CIA. This was during the hostage crisis and the Iran-Iraq War. It's important, by the way, that I mention the date 1980. The Iranian Revolution had occurred the year before. I want to make it clear that I was not the CIA analyst who missed the Iranian Revolution. In fact, my predecessor wrote in the summer of 1978, 4 months before the Shah fell, that Iran is not now in a revolutionary nor even a pre-revolutionary situation, which of course is one of the reasons he was my predecessor. And several years later in my career, I was the assistant director of the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency for non-proliferation policy, and it was my job in the U.S. government to try to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons around the world. And there again was Iran. Iran began a covert nuclear program in 1984. They have been after this for now more than a quarter of a century. And they aren't there yet, which is, if you think about it, quite remarkable. We started to build an atomic bomb in 1940, at a time in which no one had ever done it before. You couldn't download how to do it on the internet since there was no internet. There were no computers to help do the modeling, and we had an atomic bomb in 5 years. The Iranians have been after it now for more than a quarter of a century. They are close, but they aren't there yet. One of the reasons that they aren't has nothing to do with the knowledge about how to do it. That's generally easily available. What isn't easily available is highly enriched uranium and the technology to produce it. It's not like you can go into a Walmart and buy centrifuges. Centrifuges are these long cylinders that speed around at supersonic speeds that separate the fissile part of uranium from the non-fissile part. Natural occurring uranium is about 1% fissile. And the part that is, the isotope that is, has a different atomic weight than the rest of it. And when you spin it around very, very rapidly, because there is an indifferent atomic weight, it separates. And to run a nuclear power reactor, uranium has to be enriched to about 3% fissile. To get to a nuclear weapon, you need about 90% enriched uranium. But if you can do one, you can do the other. Iran is a long-standing member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means it has legally forsworn obtaining nuclear weapons. And virtually everything that it does in the nuclear field is supposed to be under the constant monitoring of the International Atomic Energy Agency. They are supposed to know about everything that Iran does in the nuclear arena. And yet for 25 years, Iran had a secret nuclear program in which they forgot to mention certain things to the IAEA. They forgot to mention, for example, that they had built a huge uranium enrichment facility in Natanz, Iran, that has a capacity for 55,000 centrifuges, that if they were all up and running, it's enough for Iran to produce enough highly enriched uranium for somewhere between 30 to 50 nuclear weapons a year. Right now, they have 8,000 centrifuges installed that are now spinning and enriching uranium. I'll come back to that in a minute. They forgot to mention to the International Atomic Energy Agency that they had illegally imported uranium. They forgot to mention to the Atomic Energy Agency that they had imported from Pakistan the designs to build centrifuges and now manufacture them themselves. They forgot to mention that they imported from Pakistan the design to take highly enriched uranium, which is a gas, to convert it into a metal, and to shape it into a hemisphere to serve as the core of a nuclear weapon. There is no other reason on Earth to do that other than to serve as the core of a nuclear weapon. They forgot to mention that they had a military program devoted to their nuclear program, separate from any civilian application. They forgot to mention that they experimented with plutonium, the second way to get to a nuclear weapon. Plutonium does not exist in nature. It is only the byproduct of running nuclear fuel rods through a power reactor, and it is produced as part of the gunk that comes out, the spent fuel. And then you need to reprocess it and separate it from the rest of the gunk. They experimented in doing that. They experimented with the radioactive isotope polonium. You may remember a few years ago the story of this ex-KGB agent in London who had become a dissident, who someone put a fleck of polonium on his wrist, and he died an agonizing death 3 weeks later. Other than killing former KGB agents in London, the only use for polonium is to trigger a nuclear explosive device. I could go on at some length about all of the things that Iran did that they forgot to mention to the IAEA that are now known. And I hasten to add that they aren't known from intelligence. They are known because once this enrichment facility was revealed by an Iranian opposition group, the IAEA went in and found it, and at that point got much more active in trying to find other things in Iran, and everything I just mentioned has been seen by the inspectors of the International Atomic Energy Agency. This isn't guesswork. What's guesswork is, what else do they have that we are unaware of? You may remember last September, the president revealed that there was a second enrichment facility that was under construction in Iran, outside of the city of Qom, on a Revolutionary Guard base that they were building into a mountain. That was a secret covert facility. Today, Iran has enough low-enriched uranium that if it were continued to be enriched to highly enriched uranium, it's enough for about 3 nuclear weapons. They are now enriching uranium to 20% enriched. When you enrich, it's not an arithmetic progression. If you enrich to 3 to 5%, it takes you a certain amount of time. The next time you do it, it gets to 20%. The next time you do it, and each time you do it, you raise it to higher levels, it takes less and less time to enrich. It's at 60%, and the next time it is at bomb grade. So when you have enriched to 20%, you are 85% of the way to bomb grade, highly enriched uranium. And they are now enriching to 20%. They have a very sophisticated, diverse nuclear infrastructure that is spread throughout the country, built into mountains, built underground. The enrichment facility that they built in Natanz, this mammoth enrichment facility, is built 70 feet below the Earth's surface, with 70 feet of concrete between it and the top, between it and the surface. Most of their installations are heavily guarded, and it's a very advanced nuclear program, such that if, in fact, they decided tomorrow to go hell-bent for a nuclear weapon, they probably could have that one within a period of a year, year and a half, 2 years. That's the kind of window time frame that we are looking at. Now, Iran says it wants nuclear power to generate electricity because someday they will run out of oil and natural gas. Iran has, by the way, the second largest combined total of oil and natural gas deposits in the world. But they are right. Someday they will run out of oil and natural gas. The last projection I saw was sometime in the 26th century. So it's not a particularly urgent problem for them. And they have spent billions and billions of dollars to acquire the entire nuclear fuel cycle, which would allow them the capability to produce nuclear weapons. And they do so despite the fact that they are members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and have forsworn getting nuclear weapons. They spent billions and billions on a nuclear program at the same time that they were spending virtually nothing on their energy sector, on their oil and natural gas. From the day that the Shah left to now, Iran's ability to pump oil has gone down by about 40%, and their population has doubled. They are having real production capabilities because they have invested virtually no money in their oil fields, and they are degrading and they are aging. That actually is, if you think about it, fairly good news. The Iranian economy is incredibly mismanaged. Their rate of inflation is somewhere officially at about 15%. It's actually much higher. Their rate of unemployment is well into the high double digits, up to, it's close to 20%. And again, that's an underestimation. 65% of Iranians are under the age of 30. And unemployment falls most heavily on them. The regime has covered over these problems by providing massive subsidies to Iranian citizens, such that it costs somewhere about 42 cents a gallon to buy gasoline in Iran, because they subsidize the price of gasoline. They also subsidize basic foodstuffs, rent, other energy supplies, heating oil. And Iran is running out of money. When oil was selling at $450 a barrel, Iran was raking in the money and built up a considerable stockpile of foreign reserves. They have now burned through that because of the subsidies. What?
It was never
I'm sorry, when the price of a gallon of gas was $4.50. Yeah, right. Right. And here you like that price, I assume. When oil was $4.50 a gallon, they were raking in the money. They've gone through that, and they now have passed legislation to end the subsidies, which will dramatically impact the normal population of Iranians. Iran is not the country that many people think it is. Here are a couple of interesting statistics. The United States has the largest number of web bloggers in the world. The country with the second largest number of bloggers is Iran, because it's beyond the ability of the government to contain. And every time they contain it, there are massive demonstrations and they have to relent. 60% of university students in Iran are women. It is a very well-educated country, a country with a long tradition and a very proud history, who feel themselves a part of the world and want to be a part of the world. This is a government that now knows it has lost the faith and confidence of millions of its citizens because they were out in the streets last summer after the fraudulent election in Iran. They know how they came to power, by having massive street demonstrations in Tehran, which the Shah contained for a very long period of time, which is why my former colleague got it wrong. Because when he wrote that, it didn't look like there was going to be a revolution. And today, so far, this regime is using the Revolutionary Guard and the besieged, who are the thugs of the Revolutionary Guard, to maintain a very repressive control in their own country. And yet they know that at a certain point, the Shah's tools of repression, the military and the Savak, stopped firing on their own people. And they fear that that may occur again, that their own tools of repression may at some point stop firing on innocent Iranians. So where are we? The United States, over the last actually 5 years, has sought to engage the Iranians. First, for the first 3 years, as part of a collective called the P5 plus one, the permanent five members of the Security Council, United States, Russia, Great Britain, France, and China, plus Germany, sought to negotiate with the Iranians a peaceful conclusion to the nuclear issue and offered Iran an incentive package in which we, the United States, said, you want nuclear power? We will provide you with nuclear power reactors, and we will provide you with the fuel rods to run them, and then we will take back the spent fuel rods. Spent fuel is a huge problem. We have fuel rods sitting in pools outside of nuclear power reactors in this country and throughout the world because no one knows what to do with the spent fuel. We were going to store it in the Yucca Mountains in Nevada, and for some reason, the good people of Nevada decided they didn't want it there. And so we would take back the spent fuel. And there's a good non-proliferation reason to do that. Because nuclear power reactors, if you take back the spent fuel, provide no proliferation risk. It's only that the spent fuel, in which you could extract the polonium, that would provide a nuclear proliferation risk. We said, we will remove you from sanctions, we will allow Americans to invest, we will allow all kinds of trade, and we will offer you a security guarantee that we will not seek your overthrow. And all we ask in return is that you live up to your freely undertaken international obligation to be absolutely transparent in your nuclear program and absolutely clear that you are not developing nuclear weapons, which means not having a full nuclear fuel cycle. And the Iranians refused. President Obama came into office. He said, you know what? We'll continue to try to do this through the P5 plus one, but we will also make it clear to the Iranian regime that we, the United States, are prepared to sit down with them by ourselves and negotiate with them. Early on in his administration, he wrote two private letters to the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, seeking to negotiate. And both of those letters went unanswered. And so President Obama said, look, we will seek to engage Iran and we will seek to continue a diplomatic path. But if Iran continues to reject that, then we will seek to try to change their nuclear behavior through economic pressure. Over the course of the last 15 years, Congress has passed several pieces of legislation to try to impose economic penalty on Iran, which successive administrations headed by people of both parties didn't execute, didn't implement. And they didn't for a reasonably good reason. Since the United States conducts no trade with Iran other than in food and medicine, American companies don't do business in Iran. And so if you were in fact to sanction a French oil company for investing in the Iranian oil sector, you're sanctioning a company that's breaking no French law. It's an extraterritorial sanction. And for some reason, the government of France doesn't like it when we sanction a French company for doing something which isn't illegal in France. And if you think you've got a long period of time before Iran actually acquires a nuclear weapon, you are prepared to let the diplomatic process unfold and to take its course. But we now know that Iran is getting dangerously close to a capability to actually have a nuclear weapon. And therefore, over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, 4 successive UN Security Council resolutions under Chapter 7 imposed mandatory sanctions on Iran. Throughout the UN system, There is only one kind of resolution that carries the force of international law, and that is a Chapter 7 resolution. Chapter 7 of the UN Charter deals with international peace and security, and it allows the UN Security Council to impose mandatory resolutions that are the obligation of every member of the UN to enforce. They are the highest form of international law. The last of these was passed in early June of this year. Following that, the United States Congress passed again a new piece of legislation to impose crippling sanctions on Iran that I will discuss in a moment. The EU, for the first time in its history, imposed significant, meaningful sanctions on Iran, followed by the Australians, the Japanese, and the South Koreans. These are, by the way, Iran's largest trading partners. The United States Congress, in its legislation, did lots of things. I will talk about three. The first thing that it did is said, if you want to receive a contract from the United States government, you have to certify that you are not doing anything in Iran that violates any of our sanctions law. And so, if you are Royal Dutch Shell, Shell Oil, and you want a contract with the United States to provide jet fuel to American military planes in Europe, you're now going to have to certify that you are not investing in Iran or selling Iran refined petroleum products. Over the course of the last decade, the U.S. government contracted out $107 billion worth of contracts to companies doing business in Iran violating U.S. law. That will no longer be the case. The second thing that this legislation did is it said to anybody who sells, ships, or insures the sale of refined petroleum to Iran may be sanctioned and subject to not being able to do business in the United States. Iran has so mismanaged its energy that despite having all of this oil in the ground, it doesn't have enough internal refining capability to meet its own domestic requirements for gasoline. They have to import up to 40% of their gasoline. And this says anybody who sells it, ships it, or insures the sale may lose the ability to do business in the United States. And for virtually all of the companies involved, they do huge business in the United States and relatively little business in Iran. As soon as this legislation was passed, all of the companies who were selling, Western companies who were selling refined petroleum to Iran, stopped. Lloyd's of London, the largest insurance company in the world, and a major insurer of ships around the world, said it would no longer insure ships delivering refined petroleum products to Iran. The result of that is, in any given month, Iran receives between 11 and 13 huge supertankers of refined petroleum. They come to the port of Bandar Abbas and offload into an Iranian pipeline. In the month of June, before this legislation passed, 12 such super tankers went into Iran. In the month of July, the month following the legislation, 3 did. In the month of August, 1 did. And so far in September, none have. The third thing that this legislation does, it says if you're a non-US bank, since remember, American banks aren't allowed to deal with Iranian financial institutions, says if you're a non-US bank and you're dealing with an Iranian financial institution that in any way supports the government's program to get weapons of mass destruction or helps to launder terrorism money that Iran sends around the world, or do any kind of financial transaction with the Revolutionary Guard, in Iran not only suppresses their own people, they are the people who are in charge of Iran's support for terrorism around the world, and they are the major controllers of the Iranian nuclear program. If you are conducting any financial transaction on behalf of the Revolutionary Guard and you're dealing with a bank that does that, you will lose your ability to engage the American financial system. For virtually all of these international banks, they do a huge volume of international financial transactions in dollars, because the dollar is the international currency. And every time they conduct an international financial transaction in dollars, they have to clear that transaction through the American banking system. The same way when you write a check, you have to clear it with your bank. And if you can't do that in the United States, for most international banks, it puts them out of business. In June, there were 59 international banks having relationships with Iranian financial institutions. Today, there are 28. 31 banks in 3 months have stopped doing business with Iranian financial institutions, and that's before the U.S. government starts to implement this legislation. They only begin to implement this legislation on September 30th. We all know what it looks like when you think your financial system is about to collapse. Governments can't run, countries can't do business unless you have a viable financial system. And if anything will bring the Iranians to the table, it may be the threat that their financial system will collapse. Now I want you to think about for a moment, what happens if all of these efforts fail? What happens if the Iranian regime says, you know, screw it, we are going to get a nuclear weapon no matter what? They may. Sanctions work sometimes, sometimes they don't. So I ask you to think about what the world looks like if Iran has acquired a nuclear weapon. First, their own prestige in the region goes up dramatically as other states in the region seek to appease their now newfound power and strength. At the same time, these Arab Sunni regimes, who have an inordinate fear of a Persian Shia bomb, will develop their own nuclear capabilities. Over the course of the last 3 years, 14 separate Arab states have announced their intention to explore their newfound interest in quote-unquote peaceful nuclear energy. And it is very likely that we will wind up with a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. And if you think about it, that's not exactly the region in the world where you would like to see a nuclear arms race break out. And if nuclear weapons spread throughout the Middle East, 60 years of American efforts to contain the proliferation of nuclear weapons will be lost. And we will all live in a much more dangerous world as other countries seek to acquire a nuclear capability. The prospect for nuclear terrorism will go up tremendously. Assume for a moment that Iran wants to be a responsible nuclear weapon state and not allow its technology to be spread anywhere. It's an interesting assumption, but assume it for the moment. To ensure that, you would have to make sure that everybody in the Iranian nuclear chain of command agrees with that, and that no one would seek to smuggle out nuclear technology. You know, you don't need a missile to deliver a nuclear weapon. You need a suitcase. What happens 3 years from now if Hezbollah announces it has smuggled a nuclear device into Midtown Manhattan? What do we do then? Do we accede to their demands? Do we call their bluff? The prospect for nuclear terror will go up exponentially. It is a major international security headache. Third, it could very well speak the end of the possibility of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. For there to be peace, it means that Israel will have to cede most of the West Bank. And it will have to be certain that Hamas, who is a major client of Iran, who over the course of the years between 2005 and 2009, when Israel withdrew from Gaza and uprooted Israeli settlers there, until it finally was forced to go into Gaza, 8,000 rockets were fired from Gaza into Israel. And if you give back the West Bank, you are opening up virtually every single Israeli population site into rocket range. And Iran, with a nuclear weapon, that all of a sudden Israel will have to be concerned that some nuclear technology hasn't gotten into the hands of Hamas, or that Hamas will not feel so emboldened by the fact that they now have a nuclear patron. The prospect of them being able to feel secure in giving up the West Bank becomes a virtual impossibility. It's not a pretty prospect. And I'm not talking about whether you can deter Iran, which is an interesting question. You might be able to, but everything that I just mentioned happens whether you deter their use or not. And there is, of course, always the prospect, always the possibility that Ahmadinejad might actually do what he threatens to do, which is to wipe Israel off the map. I will tell you, with great misfortune, the Jewish people have actually learned to take seriously when people threaten to exterminate you. And so this represents for Israel an existential threat. That's why we should all hope that the sanctions actually work. Because if they don't, at some point in the relatively near future, a policymaker will be prevented with two very bad options. One is you attack Iran militarily, you attack their nuclear infrastructure militarily to try to prevent them from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, or you allow them to get a nuclear weapon. To put this in the language of French President Sarkozy, you bomb Iran or Iran gets the bomb. Those are not two attractive policy options, and no policymaker wants to be confronted with that kind of choice. Think about if you actually resorted to a military attack, the kind of response that you could get from Iran. Think about the impact it will have on the oil market, the psychology of the oil market, and at least a short-term spike in the price of oil at a time of fragility in the global economy. Iran could mine the Straits of Hormuz, a narrow passageway in the Persian Gulf through which about 30% of the world's daily oil flows. Iran could lob a few missiles into the Saudi oil fields, again, causing great anxiety in the oil markets. Iran could unleash terrorism anywhere it chose to, in the United States, around the world, against Americans, against Israelis. This is the regime that blew up the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in 1994. It could unleash the 60,000 rockets that Hezbollah has sitting in southern Lebanon. It could unleash the 10,000 rockets that Hamas has in Gaza. It's not a pretty option. Moreover, attacking the Iranian military, the Iranian nuclear infrastructure, is not easy. They have heavily defended it and put it in places hard to get to, which is why it is, I believe, so important for us now to fully implement the sanctions regime against Iran in the hope that we will change Iranian behavior, that they will feel impelled to at least suspend their nuclear program. Is there any likelihood of this? I will tell you, I think there is. Let me digress for just a minute. When I worked at the CIA on Iran, I wrote a research paper on Iranian foreign policy, and this was like 1982, 83, at a time in which the war with Iraq was going fairly well, and they were sending their agents up and down the Persian Gulf trying to foment Islamic revolution, and they appeared to be on the march. I wanted to title the paper, you have to sort of visualize this, Bullish Shiite Diplomacy, Iran on the March. Sort of think about what bullish Shiite looks like together. And for some reason, the CIA wouldn't let me title that. But in that paper, I did talk about something which was not particularly original to me, that you could have read about it in virtually any newspaper, was a fairly pragmatic streak in the Iranian regime's behavior. Pragmatism, by the way, should not be considered coterminous with moderation. They mean different things. A pragmatic regime in Iran had no problem taking American hostages in Lebanon. It also had no problem releasing them in exchange for American arms and money. That's pragmatism. Moderates wouldn't take hostages to begin with. And in the mid-1980s, when the war fortunes weren't going so well, and they were in fact running short of military supplies, this regime in Iran, and it's virtually the same cast of characters, this regime in Iran paid the United States money to have American military hardware shipped to Iran, coming on cargo planes, leaving from Israel. They paid the great Satan money for military equipment delivered from Israel, the little Satan. That's fairly pragmatic. And in the year, you may remember that, by the way, it was called the Iran-Contra Affair. We took the money and gave it to the Contras because the U.S. Congress has said no U.S. money can be spent on the Contras. In 2003, when there were American soldiers to their left and to their right in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the EU was threatening the imposition of meaningful sanctions on Iran, Iran suspended its enrichment program for 2 years until it figured out nobody was really serious about going after them. They have acted with pragmatism when their backs have been against the wall. And the question now is whether we will have the political courage and the political will and the international fortitude to put that kind of economic pressure on Iran to actually get them to change their behavior. That is the test of our time. And the consequences of that test, whether we succeed or whether we fail, will be with us for decades to come. Thank you very much. Sandy.
If we put enough pressure on them and they do agree to comply, how will we know for sure they're doing it?
Aha. We know their declared facilities, and they will be inspected. When Iran shut down its enrichment for 2 years, there were international inspectors monitoring the fact that they had shut it down. There may be sites that covert sites. The second enrichment facility that was announced last year was a covert site that they were building. All I can tell you is that most people think we have a pretty good handle on their program. One of the first things I learned at the CIA was you don't know what you don't know. And so the possibility of secret sites exist, and that will be a matter for intelligence to discover. And we do have some track record in that. And hopefully we will know. Yes.
Do you think we're seeing a third option right now, which is sabotage of their facility?
Absolutely.
Who do you think's doing that?
Okay. There is one other part of this story, which is also good news, which is that the Iranians are having problems with their nuclear program. They're centrifuges. They have a first-generation centrifuge that they got from Pakistan that didn't work particularly well for the Pakistanis. And they break down on them all the time. These centrifuges are put in cascades of 164 centrifuges that you run this uranium fluoride gas through to enrich. And every time one of them, a centrifuge in that cascade, breaks down, you have to shut down the entire cascade. You have to remove the broken centrifuge and replace it. It takes a long time, and lots of them break on them. They are in the advanced stages of actually designing a much more efficient and much more reliable centrifuge that will be somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 to 5 times more efficient than the ones they have now. And they could begin installing those at some point over the course of the next several months. So that's a worrying part of this. But it's not guesswork that efforts have been made to gum up the works here. There have been very reliable newspaper stories. I'll give you one. There was a Swiss company I read about this in the New York Times, that was actually a major conduit of technology to the Iranians, that somehow we managed to convince to start giving them faulty equipment. And I am sure that, without any certain knowledge, that my former employer is fairly deeply involved in trying to do that, and I assume others around the world are as well. And it has had some success. Look, if you would have asked me 5, 6, 7 years ago, how long will it take Iran to get a nuclear weapon? I would have said to you then, 1 to 2 years. Pretty much the same answer I'm giving you now. And we have been very lucky in that the time it has taken has been so extended, in part because of the difficulty of getting the technology, and in part because we've been reasonably successful at gumming it up.
The scenario you paint for the ways that we should work towards preventing this in Iran, is it also the same for the other rogue nations, like
for
North Korea?
Aha. It's fundamentally different for North Korea, and it's different in two respects. The first is the North Koreans already have the bomb. And so what we seek to do in North Korea is to roll it back. That is much harder than stopping them before they get it. The second is that North Korea is not Iran. North Korea is a hermetic kingdom in which the regime there, one of the worst in the world, is perfectly happy to see 1 million of their own people starve to death. That can't happen in Iran, because the Iranian people are not prepared to be cut off from the rest of the world. They see themselves as part of the rest of the world. So we do have different views. Look, we have been at the negotiating table with North Korea for 16 years trying to walk it back, unsuccessfully so far. So we don't want to get to that point with the Iranians, because once you have a nuclear weapon, it does change everything. When I was the assistant director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency in 1990, if you would have asked me how far Iraq was away from a nuclear weapon at that point, I would have given you our general estimate, which was that they were 5 to 8 years away. After the war, we went in and destroyed the Iraqi nuclear program. We took out literally tons and tons and tons and tons of it. But we discovered that Iraq was about 1 year away from a nuclear weapon. If in fact Saddam Hussein had waited 1 year or 1.5 years to invade Kuwait, we never would have done what we did. Because having a nuclear weapon fundamentally alters the strategic balance. And so the effort has to be made in this case to try to prevent Iran from acquiring that capability.
Perhaps a really elementary question, but with North Korea, it's such a pride and prestige. My degree was international studies, focused on South Asia, nuclear proliferation, and I did various papers through that. And the main reason some of these poor countries get it is for the pride and the prestige.
Absolutely.
You referenced that for Iran, but
yes.
What else do they gain by having it? I mean, there's the Shiites and
yes.
That dimension to it, but I mean...
Okay, so there are several things. One, there is the prestige of having one. Second, in all honesty, the Shah wanted a nuclear weapon, in part for the prestige. They don't call it the Persian Gulf for nothing. They do see themselves as a major player. And the second reason is, and I don't think they're wrong in this, they believe if they acquire a nuclear weapons capability, nobody will mess with them, that it is the ultimate guarantor of their regime. And they are probably right about that. So it's easy to understand why they want one. It doesn't make me sleep any better at night understanding that.
Uh, Do we or do we not count on Israel as being our ace in the hole?
Well, I hope we don't have to. We shouldn't have to. This is a problem that confronts the international community with huge ramifications for the security and stability of the international community. And therefore, it ought to be dealt by the international community. And we are now seeking to do that. President Obama has done a very good job in trying to actually herd cats, otherwise known as the international community, to actually take action. And has been reasonably successful at it. Your question is, what happens if all else fails? Will Israel, in fact, bomb Iran? I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know that they do. This is the kind of decision you don't make until you actually have to make it. I do know, speaking purely analytically, that for Israel, an Iranian nuclear weapon represents an existential threat, and a country reborn on the ashes of the Holocaust is unlikely to suffer the prospect of a second Holocaust. But it should not be up to Israel to solve this problem for the world.
Some people mention that containment, defense, deterrence is a real strategy as opposed to prevention. Can you maybe debunk that for us?
Sure. The argument is, look, we deterred and contained the Soviet Union for 50 years.